Now on The Pulse, useful and healthy information for you and your family. It's Northeast Delta Dental Radio with Tom Raffio and the Northeast Delta Dental Team.
Welcome to Northeast Delta Dental Radio. I'm Tom Raffio for Northeast Delta Dental Radio, and I'm also the head coach of Northeast Delta Dental. And many times on this show, we feature community partners. And today, though, we're actually going to feature an author and an inspirational speaker. His name is Bob Faugh, and he has written a book that has been recently published. It's called Energize, Ignite Passion and Performance with User-Friendly Brain Tools. I've read it twice. My copy is already dog-eared. And Bob, thank you for coming in this weekend. I also know on June 15th and 16th this weekend, your birthday is June 16th. So to take time out of your birthday celebration to come into a studio with me, that's pretty awesome. So that's pretty energizing in itself, I would guess, right?
It is. It's very energizing to be here. I really appreciate it, Tom.
Now, when I read your book, and you came very highly recommended from my VP of Human Resources, Connie Roy-Jakowski, who you know, and in the spirit of transparency, and Connie said, you've got to get Bob on the show. You've got to get Bob on the show. Human beings and the old fight, flight, or freeze, and the physicality related to that. But as I also learned, there's a mental component of that. So why don't you start there and tell us about the fight, flight, and freeze analogy that you use in the book, which I found really fascinating.
Sure. Thank you, Tom. I find that just like the trainer talks about, that it really affects everything that we do. Because obviously our mental capacity is all physical as well. And when the fight, flight, or freeze kicks in our brain, it's part of, to get complex, it's the limbic system. But I prefer my book, as you know, to talk about the caveman part of her brain, the most primitive part of her brain that's responsible for fight, flight, and freeze, just to make it simpler. So when that caveman gets activated and we feel fight, flight, or freeze, a number of things happen biochemically. The one of the most compelling things, of course, we get the adrenaline coursing through our body. Everybody knows about that, right? It gives us energy, moves us forward, all that, which is good. That's fantastic. Here's the other thing it does. It kicks off what's called cortisol, which is a neurochemical, which, by the way, when you're in a really survival situation, it's a really good thing because it helps. It narrows your focus and makes you look at things very rigidly, very black and white. And which is great because then you can look for the threat, you can look for the enemy and what to do about it. It's really great. However, the fight, flight, and freeze responses also occur at work. They also occur at home just because there's a perceived threat. Because that part of our brain, the caveman part of our brain, doesn't know the difference. It's kind of weird, but it doesn't know the difference between a real threat and what's actually just a perceived threat. So we can get that fight response at work. So, for example, we're really angry about something, and even though there's this little voice in the back of our head saying, please, no, don't hit reply all. We hit reply all, out goes the email, and we tick off a whole lot of people and really look like a fool.
It's funny you mention that, because I always say to my employees who have that learning experience of doing a reply all and then regret it is, you can always do tomorrow something like that. Take a deep breath, wait on it, and maybe a cooler head will prevail. Is that, I mean, that's overly simplifying, but.
You're actually saying it really well, Tom, because it takes, if you calm down right away, it takes about 18 minutes for the cortisol to quiet down in our system and for us to be able to think creatively again. But often we ruminate, which just keeps it going. So I think it's a really good, matter of fact, I give that piece of advice as well to my clients, which is take a day before you send that. As a matter of fact, make sure that when you write that email, you do not put anybody's name in the to-do line, and don't do it until you've edited it.
The other thing I say to my employees, my employee colleagues, my teammates is think in terms of every email as if you are on the front page of the Union Leader, Concord Monitor, and the Boston Globe. Think of it that way, because no email ever gets erased. It's there. It's there forever. So you're obviously an inspirational speaker, a motivator. How did you get, if you will, motivated to do the research necessary to write such an inspiring book?
Well, it's a long story, and I go into it in my book, but just sort of to give you the Reader's Digest version, when I was...
No pun intended.
No pun intended, exactly. when I was a teenager, I was actually a very negative person. I struggled with depression. I got in trouble with the law. Just life was really miserable, and I had really a lot of despair. I didn't have any hope for life. And thankfully, particularly when I was about 18 and on, I discovered a lot of people and a lot of different techniques for changing that. And I was able to, particularly in my 20s, to really change my life around, turn my life around, and started then helping other people. And I found that not only do I like doing that volunteer-wise, I actually work with trauma survivors, people who've gone through tough times like I did, but also I really love doing it in my work. I started doing team building and things like that, and I was always fascinated about why some things worked. And there's a lot of theories out there that I was taught, you know, in learning how to be a consultant, a change consultant. But I was like, well, what's the actual facts? And so I started studying more of the research, particularly because a lot of the theories out there felt wrong to me. Like, they just felt like they're overly negative, really bringing people down. I would experiment with them. I would use them with clients, and they would actually go backwards. And so I started experimenting and trying different things. And I learned there's some great movements out there. But I always want to know, what's the facts behind it? You know, what's the real science? And so I started researching. I started subscribing to magazines like American Scientific Mind and things like that to find out what's going on with our brain. Well, I started sharing that with my clients, and most of them looked at me and yawned, okay, because neuroscience is not very interesting.
Brain surgery is not interesting?
Brain surgery is totally interesting if you're having the surgery done to
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Or hopefully to the surgeon.
But not if you're the listening audience.
No, right. The neuroscience, when you start talking about the prefrontal cortex and, you know, the hippocampus and all that stuff, people's eyes just glaze over. So that's why I started coming up with these characters to try to make it sticky and interesting. So I talk about the three parts of our brain. The caveman, as I said before, responsible for survival. Fight, flight, and freeze. The thinker, which is really the prefrontal cortex, right? That's responsible for being able to think logically and clearly. And also there's a third character, which is sort of a dynamic. It's not just a part of the brain, but we call it the artist. And the artist is that when we get in that mode, where's that beautiful balance between the caveman's energy, the thinker's clarity and focus, where we create and really get thoughtful and able to, and actually get really passionate about what we do. We can energize.
So a particular human being obviously will be situational, because there'll be times where you want to be artists, and as you said, there are times if you are truly in a dangerous situation, you know, running away from it or fighting it is, you know, the appropriate response. So how do you teach people in your talks and in your book to know which compartment to be in?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question, because all three are part of us all the time. And one of the things that I talk about, because I teach courses on this as well to our corporate and nonprofit clients, and one of the things I talk about is get your act together. So the act stands for artist, caveman, and thinkers, because really they're a team. The caveman, you want it in a calm mode. Imagine a caveman meditating, if you will. And, well, it's like that. It's like a fuel source. It's giving us energy. And the artist is the creative part. So I talk about calm the caveman. Like, whatever's going on in your life, any major changes, calm the caveman, right? Create images in your mind or thoughts about what's safe about it, what's good about it. Energize the artist. Start thinking about what you really love about this type of stuff, what's excited about it, what's in it for you. And then convince the thinker. So with the thinker, you want to be able to give logic and facts and say, if we do this, that will happen. So that's the sort of the secret to
the whole thing. Calm the caveman, convince the thinker, energize the artist. I love it.
Yeah, thank you.
So your book, Energize, Ignite Passion and Performance, if someone wanted to buy that, could they go on Amazon? And,
yes.
And it's in bookstores as well?
That's right.
One of the things you said in your book is you had a breakthrough when you were younger. You kind of used a white wall as a reflection tool. So tell us what that was all about.
Yeah, so that was, like you said, it was a breakthrough for me. I was 17 years old, and as I said earlier, I really struggled with depression and also anxiety, which I didn't realize I did. But my father, in an attempt to try to reach out and give me some help, gave me a book on depression. And I read in the preface this whole technique about you can either just stare at a white wall or visualize that you're looking at a white wall. And so I just closed my eyes and imagined I was looking at this white wall. Of course, in my head, I'm thinking, this is ridiculous, right? What in the world is this going to do for me? But I did it anyway, and I visualized it, and I had that be my complete inner movie, if you will, right? So that's all I could see in my mind. I focused on it to the exclusion of everything else. And a remarkable thing happened. I felt like this anxiety level inside of me just drop. Like, I didn't even know I was anxious until I saw that. And all of a sudden, I felt the closest to peace, sort of peace of mind that I'd heard people talk about, but I didn't know what it actually was. And I felt that. And even at 17, this was a radical awakening for me in the sense of what I focus on affects my mood. And that really, my entire career has been a lot about that. How do we help change the focus of our own mind, the people who we lead, their minds, our organizations when we communicate? How do we change what we focus on to make ourselves more effective? Sometimes we need to be more peaceful. Sometimes we need to be more energized, whatever it might be at the time.
Well, I'm going to try that technique because the Affordable Care Act is stressing me out. So I'm going to have that technique before I go into work every morning.
There you go.
Now, I know that we as leaders and people that want to become leaders, one of the things we want to do is to be able to energize others. So using the techniques that you describe in your book, I mean, how do you teach energizing others? In other words, if I'm a developing leader and I want to use some of your techniques and I want to be able to lead, you know, a work group, how do you teach that sort of motivation techniques?
Well, first of all, I think it helps for people to know a couple interesting facts about the way we work. So one is that we have what scientists call a negativity bias, right? For survival's sake, we tend to look at things far more negative than they are, more threatening. We see threats where they're not, right? Which is actually a really good thing because the one time out of 100 there's an actual threat, you're prepared. The bad side is we tend to make a big deal out of a lot of little things, and we tend to get much more stressed out by it. So there's been some great research that I talk about in the book that talks about the positive ratio. Like, you have to look at the hard truths, right? So you have to look at that negative, but also how do you balance it out? And what I come up with in the book, based on the research that I read, is a 10 positive for every one negative. It's just a goal. It's not like a rule, but aim for that. And that helps people because when they focus on that, when they're talking to their teams, they say, all right, I want to make sure to give lots of positive feedback, real feedback, no BS, right? It's got to be real. I've got to talk about what does work. I've got to talk about the goals. I've got to talk about good ideas 10 times as much as I have to talk about goals that we missed, 10 times as much as what I have to talk about mistakes that we've made. And don't get me wrong. There's times where you have to address those mistakes head on, for sure, but then get off the negative and get back to solutions.
So as human beings, we have the genetic component that we talked about, but you're also a product of your experience. And, you know, I'm a runner, and one of the things I was thinking about in reading your book, because I understand what you're saying about, you know, you have to be cognizant of the possibility of the negative, but let's look at the positive. But as a runner, I'm sure most people, if not all the people in the Boston Marathon, you know, when you finish the Boston Marathon, you know, it is the most exciting thing when you finish, particularly a long road race. It's a happy occasion. Of course, it turned into a disaster. Yeah. Do you think runners are going to have to sort of relearn that it's still 99.9% of the time running is exhilarating with the finish, as opposed to worrying about, you know, someone else maybe placing a bomb somewhere?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because it's a very real issue. It's just like after 9/11. A lot of people are afraid to fly, right? Even though this is where the thinker is extremely helpful, that part of our brain, because the odds are still, like you said, are extremely low that what you've seen before is going to happen. The challenge is the part of our brain, the caveman that reacts to threats, sees it so much more powerfully. So, matter of fact, I think it's wonderful that a bunch of people have gone back to finish it. And said, we're going to finish this. We're not going to let this fear do this. And what they've done is they've changed that, what I call the inner movie in their head. So now they no longer see it as a tragedy. I mean, obviously what happened was a tragedy, but they no longer see the race itself as a tragedy. That's still someplace they can have success and feel, rightly confident and pride about.
Switching gears a tad, one of the many things I liked about your book is it's research-based. There's some great anecdotes like the one you were saying about the white wall and yourself. So there's a lot of you in there. But there's also, you know, some good practical guidelines. And I particularly liked the stages of mastering motivation. And you talk about 8 steps: dream, build on strengths, build momentum, learn new skills, build momentum, practice new skills, continue to build momentum, and develop skills and abilities. Why don't you talk about that, how you put that into practice?
Well, you'll notice, by the way, that build momentum is in there repeatedly.
A couple times, yeah. Building momentum, art imitating life.
Exactly. And so one of the big things is you have to have a vision of where you want to go, right? So that's the dream thing. And part of the reason I use the word dream is because people tend to associate that with a positive thing. So you have to have a positive vision of where you want to go, what you want to do with your life. And as you take action and move toward that, one of the things about the way we work as human beings is that we develop habits by repeating things, doing it many times. So instead of going out and trying to learn something brand new right away, repeat it and gain momentum. And one of the great things we talk about repeatedly in the book, there's a number of tools in there for doing this, but for building momentum is to pause periodically and refresh yourself on what's my dream and what's worked so far to get there. That's one of the most powerful ways to build momentum is look back at past successes toward your dream. And to do that repeatedly as you go along. And then as you feel like you've gained some confidence and competence in what you're doing, then you say, all right, what's the next step? Let me build some more. And then you practice that and practice that. And again, to build momentum, what's working? Our brain with the negativity bias often wants to go to where we failed, what didn't work, as if we're somehow supposed to be magically perfect. Anything that's not perfect is wrong, right? Which is a really distorted but very common way of looking at life. So instead, there's a positive change questions we talk about there, and it's the goals, what works, what else, right? That you continually say, where do I want to go? Visualize that in your mind in an exciting, compelling way, and constantly think about, what have I done right to get here? Override the negativity bias and say, what have I done? And then what else can I do next step? But you continually build on that momentum, and you can go incredibly far with that.
So that old adage that our mothers and fathers and grandmothers said, you know, perfect practice makes perfect. It always comes back to that and the caveman. Now, one of the things I really enjoyed reading was, and you kind of alluded to it, is that you have to sometimes convince the thinker part of your brain. So tell us how you convince the thinker, for example. Let's say you are afraid to fly. How do you convince maybe the thinker knows that it's actually statistically no, but how do you convince the thinker on things, your steps there?
Well, you know, it's great you said that because actually, right, I was on a flight to L.A. the week before 9/11 happened, right? Before
oh, boy.
That. Yeah, so, and it was like an hour off. So obviously, in my brain, I started playing this inner movie. Oh my God, that could have been me, all this kind of stuff, and all the stuff that went with it. And I had a flight 2 weeks later. So what I did was and by the way, years ago, I used to be scared of flying. So all of a sudden, there's a resurgence of this fear kicking in. So what I did was, essentially the entire acting, the first thing was to convince the thinker, right? So I looked at the research, and there was like tens of thousands of flights in the United States every single day. And I thought about that. And I thought, you know, there's more people that literally every day die from falling in their bathtub than are killed in all plane accidents or hijackings combined. So when I thought about that, so logically, it's still safer. As a matter of fact, I also thought, when is the most safest time to fly? Is when everybody is paranoid and watching everything. So that was the logical part. And I started playing, like I said, the inner movie is kind of like these stories that play in our minds all the time, right? So I purposely played an inner movie of all these people being very focused on safety. All these paranoid people out there, and that helped calm the caveman part of me, saying, look, there's all these people out there watching. There's the marshals. There's, you know, all the people at security and everything.
Well, Bob, we're going to have you back, but that's a good tease. If you want to learn more, I urge you all to buy Energize, Ignite Passion and Performance. Bob Farr, you can go on Amazon or go to a bookstore, and Bob is also a motivational speaker. And I've learned so much just talking with you. I definitely have to have you come back.
And you can also go to my website in the book, which is energizedperformance.com.
Energizedperformance.com. Thank you, Bob. I so enjoyed it, and I commend you on writing a book, because as I'm finishing up my book on leadership with Dave Cowens, I know how difficult a challenge occasionally that can be, and I had to talk to both my caveman and thinker to make it happen.
That's right. Well, I wish you the best with it.
Thank you, Bob. Tom Raffio for Northeast Delta Dental. We'll see you next week.